How can you be part of a religious community that straight up denies
sometimes
science
it feels
or
like
sees
the church
it as suspicious?
The church seems to be stuck in their ways when the rest of the culture
Why are they so obsessed
they
with
They keep trying
people.
To get answers,
I would
but they
never
don't even
be a part
know
of a church that I'm not welcoming
The church is the most vocal political voice against immigration.
Some churches still
the
don't
one
believe
they claim
that
worship
was
the
actual
thing.
Do you understand how ridiculous that is when the majority of people on
the church seems to be stuck in their ways when the rest of the culture is
How is that actually
It seems like so much of the church is more concerned with being a good American
anti-critical thinking, homophobic, too narrow, judgmental, disconnected from what is truly happening in the real world.
The church needs therapy.
Welcome to the newest episode of The Church Needs Therapy. And today our guest is Colby Martin. Colby is the co-founder and co-pastor, along with his wife, of the Sojourn Grace Collective in San Diego. And he has written two books. The first is Unclobber, Rethinking Our Misuse of the Bible on Homosexuality. And his recently released second book is called The Shift, Surviving and Thriving After Moving from Conservative to Progressive Christianity. Colby's also a co-director for Launchpad Partners, Inc., which is an organization committed to planting and resourcing similar faith communities all across the country. And it is Colby's deeply held belief that when people are reminded that they are loved children of God, holy and exactly as they are, they begin to live from a place of freedom. He also has four boys. So on top of everything else he's doing, he's raising four young boys. He doesn't sleep. He just keeps going. It's been a few years. Colby, man, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me and to be with the listening community today.
Right. Thank you, Kevin. Right as you were doing that intro about the kids, there was this intense pounding happening over, like, I don't know.
In your heart. In your heart.
Was it my heart?
That was the years of remembering everything you've been through.
No.
I think it's coming through the mic.
I think there's a herd of elephants upstairs. I told you before we started recording that I moved down to the garage to try and avoid all of the kid noise. But I don't know. In a house of four boys, there's no avoiding kid noise. So audience and listeners, I apologize ahead of time. There might be some sounds, but
and also on our end, having two kids in an 850 square foot apartment, I'm always like, babe, I'm locking the door. I gotta lock in. There might be banging on the door, and I just have to pretend I don't hear it.
That's awesome.
Power through.
Okay, well, that was a sweet intro. Awesome,
yeah.
Thanks, Kev.
Yeah,
it's good to be here, man.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I don't know why when I say your name, I want to say Mick Sweeney, Kevin Mick Sweeney, but there's no Mick.
Well, interestingly,
why does that come to my brain?
When Sweeney's first came to the U.S. from Ireland in that wave of migration, they had a Mick in front.
And
so a lot of Sweeneys, okay, because of the marginalization of Irish people when they came and how hard it was economically, they sort of, you know, this is a totally different topic, but America as a whole was constantly sort of squeezing unique ethnic backgrounds, unique heritages into this general whiteness, which creates where we're at today. So there was a value in like, I'm not Irish, I'm just kind of blending in with the whole, right? I'm not Italian, I'm blending in. So there was kind of like this economic survival instinct need where, like, oh, if we drop the Mick, it's less distinguishable, easier to get jobs, easier to kind of be integrated and assimilated.
Wow.
So a lot of Sweeneys were Mick Sweeneys, and some people still have it. That's why.
Okay.
A lot of people still have it. So
as you're talking, thank you for sharing that. As you were saying that, I'm like, oh, I think I went to a college with a Mick Sweeney. That's why it's in my head. But anyway,
his family, they were just like, geez, they're like, we're not dropping. Don't care. Like,
they were either courageous or stupid. I don't know. Sometimes
they
lie.
He kept it. They're close. He's closer to the culture than I am.
Oh man. No, this is great. I thank you so much for having me on. As you were reading off my bio and listing those two books, I was conscious of how neither one of my books makes sense without the subtitle. And I don't know what that says. I think I need to think about better titles moving forward. Because like the word unclobber, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. I mean, I had to trademark the word. I made it up. Mm. And then the shift, what is this, a baseball book? Like, are we moving third shortstops into the gap? Like, what is the shift? So anyway.
And they also on your covers that the main title's bigger. So there's the lack of clarity without context, which can create the intrigue.
Thank you. That's what I'll tell myself. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like unclobber, you're like, but it's interesting, you know, when you see it. I want to start with this, not with any particular ideas or topics, but more with your own journey as a whole. So let's take a second to introduce yourself to the people a bit more personally. Like, since this show is The Church Needs Therapy, which means, like, when I tell people, like, I mean, I love the title of the podcast, but that's not just there's something wrong with the church. That means there's always something wrong with any living thing, especially a community or a person. But the people who go to therapy are hopeful enough to believe another future is possible. So that's always the thing here, is having the courage to name that which is getting in the way of the fullness, and also saying, but we do think there's life beyond that, right? So we focus on this relationship with the church.
I love that.
And yeah. And so let's start with this. Like, if we zoom out a bit, what are some of the bigger picture movements in your life when it comes to your relationship with the church that kind of help make some sense of where you're at today? Like, were you always in the, was your family, you know, did you grow up youth group and all that? Like, because I didn't grow up in the church, when people make those references and jokes to like musicians or like flannel graphs, I'm like, I don't know what that is. But for some people, they know because that's what they do. So tell us a little bit about that.
That's right. That. You were spared the flannel graph, Kevin?
I only know just from listening to other sermons along the way. I'm like, oh, like that's a, I get it enough, but I don't know what that means.
It was a thing, a felt board with little paper cutouts of Jesus and disciples and little boys with loaves of fish. It was a whole thing. But anyway, yeah, so I did grow up in the Baptist world. So for your listeners, I identify as a recovering Baptist. And I was part of that kind of classic rhythm of familial life where we were in church multiple times a week. So Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday, you know, midweek services, choir practice, youth group, all that was absolutely my experience. And then my parents divorced.
Sorry to cut you up, but where was that?
No, that's fine. That was in Oregon.
Okay.
Oregon. It's one of the 49 states of the mainland of America.
I'll admit my ignorance. I'm like, I've lived in New York City, LA, and Honolulu. So I'm like, if it's not those three, I'm like, it's just nice. Like Wyoming and Tennessee could be the same thing to me. I don't know.
My geography is my worst study by far. But anyway, yes, Oregon, born and raised in Oregon. And now I live in San Diego. And so my parents divorced when I was 10. And this caused some confusion in the Baptist church, because at that time, I don't know, maybe they're better now, but at that time in the culture, especially in the Baptist world, like divorce and divorced families were just awkward to be around. Like it was a pretty big deal to get divorced. And so then my mom and my two brothers and myself tried to stick around, but we just never really sort of found our way back in. We were always kind of the odd people out.
You show up to youth group, your friends are like, why are you still here?
I don't remember that. It's possible. I don't remember that. And in fact, most of even when I tell that story, that part of the story, I'm sort of borrowing some of my mom's language of her experiences, sort of being the single mom with the kids, that it just felt weird. So, or at least that was why she explained the search for a different church. So we ended up at a sort of generic evangelical, kind of a non-denominational church then, once I hit kind of like middle school and high school. And so to answer your question, sort of the first big shift in my life as it related to the church was going from that sort of nominal, you went because your family went and it was a thing you did, to then as a senior in high school, I went on a trip with my youth group that really radically altered my life in some significant ways. And in the book on Clobber, I tell this story a little bit. So I won't, you know, it's not worth telling here, but the point is I realized at that point in my life that I was professing to be a Christian and have a relationship with Jesus and inviting other people to have a relationship. But then I realized that I actually had no idea what that meant and didn't really have any grounded sense of who Jesus was myself. And so I It was very fraudulent. I was exposed to my own hypocrisy in that moment. And that caused me to really make a radical change in my life and really then dove into leading in the youth group, changed my college plans to move from graphic design to pastoral ministry. So I went to a four-year liberal arts Bible college, Baptist college still, and graduated at the top of my class with a bachelor's degree in pastoral ministry and preacher of the year award and worship leader and just really winning at the evangelical game, Kevin. Yeah. I was just crushing it. I didn't even know
that was a thing.
I don't know if it is, but we make it a thing.
I
don't know if you or your listeners do the Enneagram, but I'm an Enneagram type 3. And so winning and being the best at things is just how I approach life. And so even as a Christian, as a pastor, my goal was to win and be the best. So I was well on that path. I mean, in my own mind, I don't know if it's actually real, but the story I told myself was I'm crushing this. And then I graduated from college and got a job as an associate worship pastor at one of the largest churches in my hometown at that time, Salem, Oregon. Wow. And was there for 2 years, just really enjoying full-time ministry. But then I picked up a book by Brian McLaren, a book called New Kind of Christian, and kind of on a whim.
When would this be, like, year-wise? It happens for people.
I was about a year or two out of college, and I graduated college 2004. So I think it was like 2006 was maybe when I read that book. And so I would have been 24 years old, something like that. And I read this book and it absolutely rocked my world insofar as it did a couple things. One, it introduced me to the fact that Christians have been asking and answering these sorts of questions for a really long time and in really different ways, other than just my narrow Baptistic, evangelical, Protestant, Western American view, which I was born into and handed and trained in. And, you know, in college, I took a class called World Religions and Cults. And the basic idea was that the Baptists have it right and everybody else is going to hell. was kind of the takeaway. Like,
hey, by the way, that four square church down the road.
No.
That's a cult.
That's a cult.
Those Anglicans.
Speaking in tongues.
There, that's a cult.
Oh, yeah. The Catholics, they have no hope. I dated a Catholic girl in high school, just to try to save her soul. Missionary dating. That was a thing, Kevin. Another thing you missed out on. You missed out on flannel graphs and missionary dating. Man. Bless your heart. But this book, anyway, this book really challenged me to see that Christianity is a whole heck of a lot wider than I had ever known. So that was one thing. But the second thing it did, and maybe even more profound, was that it gave me permission to not have the right answer, or to not have an answer. It gave me permission to just be like, I don't actually know the answer to that. And up until that point, my fundamental assumption about what it meant to be a Christian was you have the right answers. That's it. Like, get the right beliefs, lock that down, be prepared, whether in season or out, to give a reason for the hope that is within you. And then just try and create disciples, which is to say, create people who also believe the same things as you. So then to have this sense that maybe it's okay to not have the answer. Maybe it's okay to answer, I don't know. That was mind blowing for me. Mm-hmm. And that, as I like to say, if I compare my faith life to like a Jenga tower, that was the first block that I kind of took out of one of those bottom rows and inspected it and was like, wait a minute, maybe it's not just about believing the right things and getting it right. So that set me on a whole journey, but that was my first major shift in my relationship to the church.
So that was like, so from that moment, there's a disruption, there's an opening. You know, a lot of times you get the sense of, you know, like a lot of times you start to discern what you're saying no to before there's a clear and full and concrete yes of what you're saying, of what is next, right? So there's this disruption, there's an opening. So do you just keep, you're like, oh, Brian McLaren, I'll read another one of his books, or like, oh, Doug Padgett, or, you know, do you just keep going down that well, what happens after that?
Yeah.
There's a trajectory that's established when you have that first disruptive, if it's Fowler, like stage three and opening to stage four, or whatever, mm-hmm. or whatever kind of maps you're using to see what's out there. You know, what happens from there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I love that you dropped some Fowler in there, and that you, I don't hear that very often anymore. Stages of Faith. That was a good book.
I feel like Fowler for some people in the church is a little bit of an opening and a gateway. So it's like before you do the spiral, you're like, this guy's a Christian. And then we can talk about the spiral after.
That's right. He does have a very non-threatening approach to the different stages of faith. That's a good point. By the way, speaking of Brian McLaren, his newest book, Faith After Doubt, he has a great framework, a great map, as you call it, for the stages of faith as well. I found
he was one of the last, before you were on, he was one of the last guests on here with that book.
Oh, sweet. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that guy. So the next step for me was to actually, I tried to start to fill in some of the blanks really fast. So if Brian's book helped me, maybe ask new questions and have permission to not know the answer, the part of me that was always incredibly theologically minded and very passionate about knowing and reading and understanding and interpreting the Bible, that part of me sort of still persisted in some pretty strong ways that aren't necessarily there now, or at least not in the same way. But back then it was still very, very cranked to 11, you might say. So what I did next was I found N.T. Wright, and I'm like, oh, here's a guy who is super smart and yet is providing ways of thinking about things other than, like I said, this Baptistic way. And so he was like this gateway drug into what I might now sort of identify as more liberal, progressive theological traditions. But N.T. Wright was kind of this off-ramp I think he is for many Protestants, for many, especially evangelicals. Totally. And so I consumed everything I could from N.T. Wright and picked up all new language for ways of thinking about Jesus and the kingdom of God and the authority of the Bible, the Apostle Paul, like all of that was just almost brand new territory for me in many regards. So I just went full on like theological. If it's not this sort of conservative, narrow Baptist, and that's part of it is, yes, I was exposed to a wider ways of thinking, but also I started to see how this really fundamental conservative Baptist evangelical perspective was fraught with a lot of what I would say now, really myopic thinking and beliefs that really don't hold up. They're really not tenable positions. So I walked away from many of those, but then I'm like, I got to fill these holes now. And I filled them with a whole lot of N.T. Wright instead of just letting the holes be filled, which is kind of more where I am now. Letting the holes be unfilled, which is more where I am now.
Yeah, those journeys are always so interesting. I think for like the newer wave of people who I think could still be considered evangelicals, but who have broadened out a little bit, I'm like, they're basically evangelicals who have read N.T., right?
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? At some point in the past 10 or 15 years.
Totally.
I want to give people this perspective, and you can share a little bit about your own experience. When you're, you know, reading Brian McLaren, reading N.T. Wright, and then you're following the footnotes, right? You keep going. There's learning communities. There's more books you're reading. When your vision is becoming wider, right? When your faith is feeling more inclusive, and when you're getting more comfortable embracing complexity, all the things that happen as we grow. It can be exciting. It is exciting. It's absolutely exciting and exhilarating. And it can also be a little scary, and it can be a little, it can sometimes cause some jolts of anxiety. Like and I didn't even have strong ideological ties to a tradition without growing up in the church, but I can remember even in my early 20s, you know, when you're reading all these things and it finally clicks, like, oh, it's this. And you immediately see all the implications of, if it's this, it means it's not that. And if it's not that, but it's this, and this is where we're going, you can see the concrete ramifications of relationships, jobs, money, family, kids, right? You can kind of make all those connections in an instant. Where I can remember reading a Doug Padgett's A Christianity Worth Believing when I was in my early 20s. And all the new creation stuff was like just really clicking for me. And I went to a Foursquare Bible College. It was one of my first time around a bunch of Christians, and they would talk about the rapture. And I was just like, I didn't grow up with this, but there's no way in hell this is where the universe is going. Just intuitively, this can't be it. I didn't have any other story. I'm just like, yeah. It can't be this. So I kind of would just like, I don't know. I'm going to leave that. I'm going to hold that tension. I don't know what to say about it. And so when it clicked of like this vision of this is moving towards oneness and healing, et cetera. And I was like, yes. I can remember sitting there and immediately it's like my heart fell into my stomach. I'm like, that puts me at odds with this entire school or my professors who I love and they're great people. And there's a cost, there's things that happen. So what are you risking? You know, it's exhilarating, but then also there's these real risks. Like what is happening? Is it also terrifying along the way? Do you start to make those connections of, I don't fit here, but where do I go? Like, what is some of that for you along the way?
Yeah. Well, early on, and I think this is true for, I would wager most Christians, especially most Western Protestant Christians. Not even Protestant, because I'm sure our Catholic siblings would identify with this as well. But early on, as soon as you start asking questions or getting curious or experiencing doubt, immediately what comes online is a fear around eternal damnation. Because we have been told, we have been taught somewhere along the way, Kevin, I don't know exactly when it is, I have some guesses, but somewhere along the way, we, I just mean like humans in general and Christians in particular, we have decided that the thing that God cares about most, the thing that the creator of the universe, whoever, whatever, however they, he, me, shape, whatever the creator is, we've decided that what they care about most is what humans believe, which I find to be pretty fascinating and relatively arbitrary. Like why beliefs? Why ideas in between our ears? Why is that the thing that God cares about most? But we've decided this. We've decided this, and then we've taught this. We've taught this to our children. We've taught this to our priests. We've taught this to our leaders. Like beliefs is what matters most to God. So then we've been told that particular beliefs are the things that will determine your eternal damnation or salvation. So everything is dependent upon basically passing the test when you die and having the correct answer when you die. Okay, well, that is a lot of pressure. That is a lot of pressure put on a person to make sure that whatever, because I'm going back to the Jenga tower, whatever Jenga blocks they pull out, make sure you don't pull out the one that's going to cause you to burn in hell. And that's scary. That's scary for all sorts of obvious reasons. Like, I can explore speaking in tongues. Maybe I can ask questions around that, or I can explore maybe the rapture a little bit. That one feels a bit safer. I can maybe take this block out about women in ministry. Maybe women can be pastors. Oh God, that one's kind of creepy, but oh, this one over here. No, stay away from that one, because that one might be the one that sort of F's everything up for me when I die. I can't touch that one. So to answer your question, or to respond to your question, I don't know if it's an answer, but to respond, immediately there is fear and anxiety that what if I pull out the wrong block? And so for me, when I sort of began this journey into sort of the Brian McLaren, whoa, there's other ways of thinking about things and it's okay maybe don't have the right answers, then into voraciously consuming NT Wright to sort of find other answers. Everything was still predicated on the idea that I had to have the right beliefs. And I began to intuit that this fear of the hell question was really having a lot of power over me. Like I couldn't really fully examine everything about my faith because I knew that there was some that I'd sort of locked off in a safe, be like, these ones I can't touch. These ones I have to, I can't risk my eternal salvation by asking questions about those ones. And so I think pretty early on, I dug into the topic of hell. I dug into heaven and hell and exploring that, because I'm like, if there's a way in which we've maybe got that wrong and I can detach from some of the fear around burning in hell forever, then maybe I can open that safe up and actually ask some of the questions that I've been too afraid to ask.
Yeah, no, that's such a, it sounds so extreme. Like, well, why would some, you know, what are the risks when people are first starting to make some of these like inner shifts or even asking the questions or even giving themselves the permission to be open to ask the questions. And because there's this unconscious five layers down beneath the surface, play it out to its logical end. If I'm wrong, I'm going to hell.
That's right.
And that's so psychologically and emotionally devastating.
Yeah, to go back to the topic of your podcast, the church needs therapy. Like, that is deep. Like, sit down on the couch. That's going to take a few sessions to get to that layer.
Yeah, and it's not all, it's like you say, it's like within the culture we grow up in or people grow up in within unique churches, it doesn't have to be explicitly said to be internalized as a whole in terms of like no one said that to me, but you pick it up along the way. Like,
that's right.
I always, you know, found that to be interesting. Like, so if you make a slight little cognitive shift, then somehow this infinite love that's just kind of pouring itself out to the world stops. Or you're, I mean, that's just, you know, like, but that's so real of, you know, the trauma that can happen for people and why people aren't open. And that really speaks to some questions I want to ask later. We're going to jump in to a specific part of your journey, but I'm going to come back to that because that gets into some of the stuff I want to talk about. With all that said, you know, you're like, you know what, let's just start with hell. Because if you go all the way, everything else feels easier after that, you know? With all that said, you've been on this evolving journey on your relationship with and understanding of the LGBTQ community, faith, church, spirituality, following Jesus, etc. And I think, like I told you before we got on, stories like yours are so important for as many people as possible to hear. Let's kind of like similar with the relationship with the church as a whole. Let's zoom in on some of those defining moments and movements in your own journey when it comes to your evolving views on LGBTQ relationships, faith, and the church. Because when you say we pick up along the way, if our Jenga tower of beliefs falls over, it literally can mean eternal damnation. Well, to start messing with Jenga blocks of LGBTQ relationships, especially in the United States of America, especially coming out of Baptist traditions, those are some, that's not Jenga blocks. For some people, that's the whole foundation, weirdly enough. Like, if you pull that out, you're done. Like,
thank you for adding that. Weirdly enough, yeah. It doesn't make sense.
No, but for them, it's like, I mean, you pick hell and that are like, those are the two you can't touch.
Yeah.
For whatever, even though that doesn't make a lot of sense historically. So how did that happen and what was that journey like for you?
Yeah, good question. So I'd graduated from college and I was about a year into my job at that church that I referenced in Salem, Oregon. And I was, my younger brother and his fiance were going to get married and they asked me to officiate the ceremony. So I had to get licensed through my church so that I could marry my, my younger brother. And so I began the process of being licensed, and the denomination that I was in at that time was the CMA, Christian Missionary Alliance denomination. And so I began the process of being licensed through them, which involved a number of things, including an interview with several of their leaders to kind of just be able to recite their specific beliefs and positions. And I remember one time I was on my lunch break studying for the upcoming interview. And I was reading through like the policies and procedures manual of the denomination. And I remember coming across this line that said something to the effect of practicing homosexuals are not permitted to be members of a church. And even though in that moment, Kevin, I would have theologically signed off on any sort of statement that reflected a traditional view of marriage or sexuality in the church, which is to say I would have signed off on, homosexuality is a sin. Gay marriage is not a thing that would be blessed by God. Even though I would have signed off theologically on all of that, when I read it, I don't know if it was just the plain language of it, or I don't know if it, maybe it was just the first time I was really confronted with the implication of holding a theological conviction like that. But I remember reading it and just having my stomach just drop, like just this instant knot in my being was formed. And I realized there's a real, I'm really out of alignment here as it relates to my head, which was firmly entrenched in this theological position, is way out of alignment with my heart, which was, but how can we just deny people the right to be a member in a church? Like, what the heck is this? And then I kept reading, and like, they couldn't serve in leadership positions, or they couldn't, like, they could only, there were like these roped off parts of the ministry. Like, here's the few parts that you're allowed to sort of serve in. But also, if you want to tithe, we'll take your money. That was my, it didn't actually say that, but that was, I was reading between the lines there. So that was for me the first moment of noticing this tension and realizing that, oh, you know what? I haven't really thought about the question of sexuality. I mean, I assumed along the way I'd picked up random teachings here and there, Romans 1:26-27, like, you know, it's men abandoning natural relations and burning for one another. And I assume I picked up somewhere along the way the Leviticus, man shall not lie with a man as with a woman, for it's an abomination. And we've all heard the good warm-hearted story of Sodom and Gomorrah and God destroying an entire city. And maybe it's because they were gay. Anyways, I'd pick these up along the way enough to be like, yeah, like homosexuality is a sin. I get it. But I'd never actually taken the time to look into it. It was never something I studied. It was never something I got super curious about. I know now that I went to school with some people who identified as LGBTQ, but at the time it wasn't known. There wasn't anybody in my high school that was like out of the closet. So that was, I didn't really do a lot in that moment with that tension. I just noted it. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I don't like the way this theology is played out in the praxis of the church. I'm not really cool with this. And I barely passed the interview. I think it was a record long 4-hour interview. There's supposed to be like 30 minutes. You just go in and check a few boxes on that. You can recite the creeds of the church, but yeah, mine took a little longer than that. But anyway, fast forward then a couple of years, and I had just kind of kept going down this journey of exploration, kept going down. Now we have language for it called deconstruction. I wouldn't have used that term back then. For me, it was just kind of trying to pursue with integrity these questions and where some of the answers were leading me to. And eventually along the way, I think my wife and I started watching Modern Family, the sitcom on ABC. And that really did a significant job of normalizing a same-sex couple. And then we watched a documentary for The Bible Tells Me So.
Some people's big shifts are like, man, I started reading this, or like my brother came out, or my sister, and you're like, Modern Family.
No, just watching TV and being like, wait, so what's wrong with gay people again? Like, hold on, what's wrong? Like, and Will and Grace, like, wait, what's wrong with gay people?
How can we not love them? How can we not?
I know I'm supposed to call that sin, but it just looks normal to be. It just looks good. But yeah, that's an excellent point. At that point, no one in my life, no family, no friends. Again, there was no gay people in my life that sort of forced me to confront that, which I think, by the way, side note, is a completely lovely and worthwhile journey. And it's a very common journey. Many, many Christians who do make a shift as it relates to their theology around LGBTQ, issues, it is because they have friends and family that come out and force them to be like, man, okay, let me listen and learn and see if I can figure this out. And what I've discovered, I don't know if you've run into this, Kevin, but I've discovered that people who are still entrenched in a more conservative, traditional position on this, they will often use that as criticism. Like, oh, you only changed your mind on that because your son came out, or you only changed your mind on that because your friend came out. To which I want to say, how is that not just the most loving thing ever to have someone in your life make this massive revelation to you, and for you to then be like, I would like to listen and learn and get curious about that. Like, that is
you're open-minded.
Yes. That's
your heart's open.
That's what you would want. That's the loving response. Like, I don't know why that is ever sort of I don't know, criticize. Like that's the sort of response you'd want. But yeah, that wasn't my experience for me. It was more just a continued pursuit of theological integrity. Like, you know what? I've experienced this tension between my head and my heart for long enough. I need to figure out what one of these two entities needs to kind of win. So either I study this and I confirm that my theology is correct, and then I just force my heart into submission. Like, no, I know this sucks, but you gotta hate the sin, love the sinner, sort of thing. Or maybe my heart will win out and I'll discover that the theology sucks, which, you know, spoiler alert, that's what ended up happening. But that's what sort of drove me into this deep dive of the clobber texts. And the clobber passages are the six or so verses in the Bible that people have historically used to justify their discrimination against those who identify as LGBTQ. So when I studied those passages, that's when I came out on the other side being like, "Oof, we've gotten this wrong. These verses do not say what we have been told they say. We do not have biblical justification to tell people who identify LGBTQ that they are unhuman, vile, gross, which are all synonyms for the term abomination." But of course, then that set me at odds with my church. But
no, it's actually quite interesting. In your own particular journey, you're already, like, in your own embodied way, answering all of the questions I have more for people on a universal level. Like, you're literally hitting every single one. It's kind of weird. So I mean, like, we could just, would we just end right now? I got the answer. Now let's talk about, you know, when I talked before, you start going on these journeys, you allow yourself to be open, which for me is one of the defining markers for somebody who actually keeps evolving, growing, being increasing in joy, is just the ability to be open. You know, I mean, it sounds quite simple, but to remain open-hearted, you know, especially as a pastor and a leader, it takes a lot to remain open-hearted when you lead. You know, it takes a lot to be open-minded when it's so easy for the mind and the ego to attach to any belief or system for any sense of security in a world that feels like so unsafe so often. So while I empathize and understand all that, openness is, you know, it continues to lay the path for growth and a natural movement of evolution, not where it's just big, you know, disruptive moments, but an actual path of a continuous flow of that. And we talk about cost and sacrifice, right? You know, now the decisions we make, the changes we go through have concrete implications. You know, you have a chapter in Unclobber about, you know, it's not verbatim, like I got fired because of Facebook or something. You go from now I'm following that rabbit trail, which is just me being open and exploring, to put it in really non-threatening language for people. You know what I'm saying? Like, to be open to truth wherever it shows up. And eventually there's some concrete, like, this is going to affect your life in a pretty significant, you know, direct way. So what eventually leads to that moment, and what, you know, is that moment for you?
Yeah. I think the chapter's called How Facebook Got Me Fired. So this was 2011. I'd been working now at a church in Arizona for almost 5 years as their worship and arts pastor. And during that 5 years, really kind of traveled a pretty significant distance away from my more conservative evangelical roots as I kept asking the questions and being open to wherever sort of spirit was taking me. And who I was in 2011 was pretty different from the version of me that graduated, you know, top of my class from Bible college. And one of those, as I mentioned,
I still wanted to win. I still wanted to crush it. That just meant something totally different now.
Absolutely. I'm just winning. I'm winning now at deconstruction. God, I really am the worst. One of the things that was pretty different was my theology around sexuality. And yet I didn't tell anybody about it for reasons that are probably obvious to most of your listeners. It just wasn't something that I shared with the people in my church or in my life. My wife and I talked about it as we kind of went on the journey together. But nobody, even in my own family, knew, because as you mentioned a minute ago, for the strangest of reasons, this topic is this massive freaking litmus test where you don't get to be a tried and true Christian in many people's eyes if you are down with LGBTQ people.
And even if it's not said, everyone knows it.
It's so weird. It's so weird. And but then in 2011, September of 2011, President Obama signed the repeal for Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was the ban that did not permit gays and lesbians from serving in the military. And at the time, I confess that I didn't really know any much about the policy. I just read the article. I'm like, oh, that's cool. That struck me as a discriminatory law. And our church is pretty anti-discrimination. My pastor and boss would always say that there's no room for discrimination in the kingdom of God. Now, I didn't know he had an asterisk on it. Read the fine print, does not apply to queer people. So I just thought Don't Ask, Don't Tell was, that's a super discriminatory practice. So how great that it's been repealed. And I just shared an article on my Facebook, just an innocuous article announcing the end of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I just put six words: I'm glad this day finally came, and shared that post. And then I woke up the next morning to just a stream of comments from people in my church that were just losing their freaking mind. Why are you actively advancing the gay agenda? Which, I'll be honest, they've never told me what the agenda was, so I don't know what it is, but I'm not certainly privy to the gay agenda. Questions like, wait, so now our church is pro-homosexuality? Just people really sort of, it was interesting because they were drawing extreme conclusions and extrapolating things that weren't necessarily indicative of the article, but actually they weren't entirely wrong. Like, yes, I, Pastor Colby, was like, I'm in favor of LGBTQ equality. I hadn't said that yet. But anyway, so that led to an emergency board meeting a couple days later where the board of elders were, forced me to give an account for my theology on sexuality, at which point I just shared with them, all right, guys, well, here's what I've been studying and here's where I've landed. And yeah, I don't think being gay is a sin. I'm in favor of same-sex marriage. And I recognize that our church is not. And I haven't taught these things. And at that time, I'm like, and I'll continue to not. Like, I will sort of submit to the church under this. Now, looking back at it now, I realize that that would have, I'm glad it didn't work out that way. Because that's just not...
Wouldn't have been healthy for anybody involved.
No, I think now I'm conscious of how so many churches do a bait and switch of all are welcome, we love everybody, all are welcome. And, your average queer person might see that on the interwebs and be like, oh, cool, we're welcome there. And then the closer they get to the Holy of Holies, then they realize, oh, what you actually mean is, if I want to stay here, then I need to stop being gay. Not all of me is welcome and celebrated. This is just this nasty bait and switch. So I think, and that church that I got fired from, I know practices this bait and switch. Like, I have held the shrapnel of the people who went there only to discover that, oh, actually we're not welcome here. It's just a brutal, inhumane practice, in my opinion.
One of the most dangerous and damaging things I've
so seen damaging.
Over with so many people.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so the elder board didn't like my answer. They took 2 days to think about it. It was over the weekend and they're like, don't come to church on Sunday. We'll fill your position while we're thinking about it. And then on Tuesday I was called in and handed my letter of termination. So I never even got to say goodbye to my church. Wow. It was just like this infectious plague that they were afraid of. And they're like, let's remove him immediately and not even let him come say goodbye to the church. But you know what, Kev, I write about in my new book, The Shift, I write about that time in my life. And I, at the time, I was obviously very hurt and very angry, and I think justifiably so. But now when I look back, I realize, you know what? The reality is that they were just doing the best that they knew how with their convictions. They were living out their convictions as best as they could. Now, I think their convictions were garbage, and I think their theologies horrible. And so that's where my anger is at. My anger is at their bad beliefs and bad ideas and the bad systems that have sort of perpetuated this. But them as individuals, it's like they were doing the same thing I was. How do I live out these convictions with integrity? Yeah. So I don't know. I guess I have a lot of compassion for that.
Yeah, no, that's great. There's always the time where you're like, I disagree with that person, but based on their internal logic, I get that.
Yeah.
And then there's also like, and that I think is so key for younger leaders who are expanding, growing, and evolving to be like, you can disagree with the conclusions people have come to without feeling the need to question their faithfulness.
Mm-hmm.
You might think it's misguided because of the way in which they're living it out, because of their beliefs. Like, sure, that's damaging. I'll call it out for what it is. That ends up doing more harm than good in the world. That actually works against the spirit who's reconciling and restoring things in the world. Mm. But at the same time, I'm not questioning your faithfulness or your love for others or your love for God. It's just the way in which you're going about it, for me, might be problematic in some ways while you're still doing a lot of good in the world, you know? Because that's just, that's always, you know, with obviously that natural movement of transcending and including, that preserves the possibility of relationship. It allows us to honor the past that's also has unfolded within us. And that's what helps keep our hearts open, our ability to live within joy, you know, kind of growing and bubbling as well. You know, so I think that's so much personal wisdom and maturity on your end to look back and be like, that's, it makes sense. I have my thoughts on it and I'll say those openly, but that doesn't, I don't hate people. You know, I don't have that because we're just doing this other thing now.
That's right.
You know? So yeah, that's huge. Let me, I'm serious. You've answered some of the ways when I, some of the questions I have. And when I zoom this out to think about people who, I feel like there's so many people who are in different stages of your journey. Right. Now, think about LGBTQ people who are always desiring a place within the church, but cisgender, straight folks, leaders, especially people who like you and I, cisgender, straight white males occupying, you know, in America, occupying arguably the most privileged position on the planet. People are in different places growing and evolving. Right. And you touched on some of those. Why it's hard. I mean, the fear of doubting is like the worst. What's the worst case scenario? You're going to go to hell. Like, you, it's a pretty big threat to have somebody that can keep them from not having the courage to ask the question. One of the things you talked about, which I have seen quite a bit, is that tension between the head and the heart. Right? I feel like there's a, I've seen a lot of people over the years living within that tension between the head, what do they believe based on what they've been taught about the Bible, regardless of how critically it's been examined or whether or not it has been, but in their heart, because it's what I see is people in their heart, they're like, they just want to embrace and welcome and be in relationship with all people. And in this case, specifically LGBTQ friends and family who are in the church. And their heart wants to do that. And the thing is, in practice, they do that in many ways, you know, just everyday folks.
Sure.
But it, but when you talk to them or if you push them on their beliefs, they would still hold to some version of a traditional view on same-sex attraction. And they live with this ongoing conflict. And it seems like at times their minds have a hard time catching up with their hearts and their bodies who are already loving and doing the work, you know, but their minds keep them and that inner alignment is not fully there, which is interesting because it seems as if the Bible is the thing getting in the way of them feeling the permission to just fully be aligned and be embracing. Like, have you seen that? I mean, you mentioned that a little bit with yourself, the desire for alignment. Have you seen that with other folks who are on their journey towards this, other friends, leaders, and pastors that you know as well?
Yeah. I think what comes up for me in that question, that reflection, is what we are, and by we, I just kind of mean humans who are studying these things. What we are discovering is that where your average person probably thinks to themselves, I come to my convictions and my opinions and my conclusions through sort of an objective, rational process. So I think about a thing and I evaluate the evidence and I look at all the sides and then I come to a conclusion and then now I have my opinion and my feelings on it. What we're actually discovering is really it's the inverse of that, is where we initially have a feeling about a thing and then we backfill that with sort of rational data. So if we were to go back to our head heart dichotomy for a minute, really most of us sort of at our gut feeling level that's where we make our convictions and our values. And then we figure out how to sort of rationalize or justify that. Now, what does that have to do with this conversation? What I've found is that your typical person who might be really still entrenched in a real traditional view on sexuality, especially religious view, I've heard it said that the mind can't go where the heart is unwilling. So even to be presented, I mean, someone could read my entire book or any other book about the clobber passages and really be presented with, you know, foolproof evidence, which, by the way, my book is not foolproof evidence. There is no such thing as foolproof evidence. Like, the people who have a traditional view on these things, they're not stupid either. Like, there's ways in which many different interpretations on many different issues just make a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. If it were that clear and obvious, then we wouldn't be having this conversation. But anyway, so they could read a really compelling argument, which I do think, by the way, my book is more compelling than the other arguments. And yet it doesn't move the needle for them. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason is because their heart has yet to be open to the possibility. Mm-hmm. And not only could they have been wrong, which is quite a threat, as we've already established, like, to admit that you've been wrong on something is super vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And can lead to a disruption of all sorts of things inside of a person if they have not practiced that in the past. Practice just being wrong and being okay with it and noticing that you survive. It's okay. So people, their mind won't be open to these compelling arguments because their heart is still closed off. Their heart is not yet. Maybe it's that their heart hasn't reconciled with their own sexuality. And by that, I just mean in the church, there is layers upon layers upon layers of sexual shame built into our freaking religious DNA. And so people are disconnected from their own bodies. They're disconnected from their own sexuality. And there's just shame and sexual repression just in droves in the church. And so people can't even come to grips with their own sexuality. Then they see oftentimes people in the queer community who are very comfortable with their sexuality and very, like, open and connected and embodied. And it's just super threatening. It's super threatening. And so that's another reason why their hearts are sort of closed off, because they might be thinking to themselves, not consciously, but subconsciously, I wish I had that sort of freedom. I wish I had that sort of lightness about my sexuality, but I don't, because I can't, because it's so sinful and gross. I got to keep it all locked down. And so there's this closed off heartness. So if the heart isn't open, then the mind is never going to be convinced of anything. Mm-hmm. Never going to, doesn't matter how compelling the arguments are. And this is what I say to people when they write to me and they say, I'm a gay kid living at home and my family just will not accept me. Like, what can I say to them? Like, how can they be convinced? And the truth is, they can't be convinced in their head unless their heart is not first open to it. Mm-hmm. And so then what I often say to people, is really, if you identify as a Christian and you are theologically convinced that the traditional view of sexuality is the correct one, but you aren't actually in relationship with anybody who identifies LGBTQ, then that needs to be your next move. Mm-hmm. Is you need to build relationships with people who identify as LGBTQ, because what that does, Kevin, and you know this, is that rehumanizes them. Absolutely. To people. Because we have, with our theology, we have dehumanized LGBTQ people. Mm-hmm. We have removed parts of their humanity, which then allows us to treat people with judgment. We can treat people pretty much like garbage, because if they're not fully human, then our conscience we don't feel bad about it. They're a monster. I don't feel bad about treating them bad because they're not even human. So they have to be rehumanized to us. And then when they are rehumanized to us, suddenly we see them for who they are, which is a beloved child of God, just like we are. Now, that's a tiny little opening in the heart. And once there's a tiny little opening in the heart, now suddenly some of these ideas and different ways of thinking about the text can start to have some footholds in our heads.
Yeah, that's, again, I mean, you're answering the things I wanted to ask. It just flows so naturally from your story. And that's where, even at Imagine, with the initiative that we started with myself and the woman I mentioned before, Dr. Jade Higa, she was a professor at UH, she now teaches at a high school, Christian, identified as queer, you know, has her own journey doing that. And so we lead this thing together called Saying Grace. And it's like a 4-week, like consecutive, say 4 Mondays in a row journey where it's like half straight, usually with a traditional view on sexuality, Christians, with half LGBTQ, mostly Christian so far. And it's just us curating these conversations and dinners together to do just that. We're like, let's, the people we talk about become the people that we talk to. Cause I'm like, you never even really sat with a person. Have you ever heard the young man who grew up, he's an athlete and he's, you know, going to go to college and play football, but he's at 17 or 18 is really starting to come to terms with the fact he's gay and the sleepless nights and the suicidal thoughts and getting like almost like kicked out of college. And have you ever, you know, seen that in person and felt that closely? Because even in that moment, like when we go through that process, we're like, our goal isn't to turn, you know, people with traditional views to make them change their mind. And our goal is not to get LGBTQ people here to become Christians. Mm-hmm. If either one of those things happened, that would be amazing, you know? And those things do happen, you know, in their own unique ways, or especially LGBTQ folks feeling like they have a place in the church for the first time, if not, you know, even if they already have a sense of knowing God. But those embodied around the table, person to person things are, because I'm like, man, I don't know what she thinks after this, the 50-year-old like auntie who's been around the church forever, but now she's taking those 3 kids surfing, like those gay kids from the church, and bringing them into her fold, you know. Or I see them exchanging numbers, you know. I see this family in the back of our church when we used to meet in a bar across the street from our house. Like, I know if I push that couple, they probably would still have traditional views. And now there's this, you know, this gay guy who's flamboyantly gay, who's also a drag queen, and he's holding their kid in the back of the bar church. And I can see that relationship. I'm like, this is where, in the mess of all of this, without realizing that those hearts are subtly open. And now the conversation's happening within the context of connection, friendship, and open-heartedness. That's a whole different thing. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. The sermons are different after that. The conversations are different after that, you know? Yeah. And as you're leading and doing things, just when I see those little eruptions of grace, those little openings for people, I'm like, this is where it starts. For me, I'm just like, that's what gets me. Like, that's just what
totally.
Yeah. Yep. Just, I love it, man.
If we can just create the space for potential magic like that to arise, that's it. Yeah. Then yes, we'll just keep showing up.
Yeah.
We'll keep showing up.
Yeah.
I love it.
One thing I would say too is, let me see what else I got left. Within that, I think one of the surprises for straight Christians in those moments, getting to know the journey of LGBTQ folks in their life of faith and going through the church and hearing sermons and silence at 10 years old about gay people when they're unsure and what that does. Like, straight people get a lot of surprises, I think, when they hear those stories. And, you know, you hear a story of this kid's like, even when I'm gay, I don't know if I fully want to be, if I can be gay, because I don't want to disobey the Bible. Where I think a lot of straight Christians, like, you would never think to hear a gay person be so concerned with disobeying God or the Bible. You know, it's not a surprise, but for a lot of people that would be a surprise because of caricatures they have about what it means to be queer, what it means to be a person of faith, etc. What would be, you know, you think about your own experience, your own relationships. If there was a lot of straight folks with traditional views who were a part of some of those relationships and conversations you've had, what are some of those things they would be surprised by hearing those people's stories of, man, these sleepless nights and I got kicked out of my home and, you know, my dad didn't talk to me for 10 years and then I ended up like living, I was outside, or, you know, what are some of those stories you've heard, some of those glimpses, what are those experiences like for people who haven't had the privilege of being in relationship with, you know, our LGBTQ siblings and hearing those stories? Now, for you as a pastor, you're like, this is what gives me the energy to, you know, to keep fighting, to keep having hope, to keep, you know, living my life for the sake of inclusion, you know, for others.
I can remember a number of years ago talking with a former colleague of mine who, when I worked with him at the time, he was not, he did not identify as gay, and I didn't certainly know that he was. He had a family, had a wife and kids, and was on the platform every single Sunday leading the music and leading the whole church, and just this incredible leader, pastor, hugely transformative in my life, an early mentor. And then years later down the road, this was after I'd gotten fired and after I'd started some of my own clobber work, then he reached out to me and I learned that he was gay, was always gay, knew he was gay from a young age. His whole life battled it. His wife knew that it was a battle for him, a quote-unquote struggle for him, but, you know, sort of he'd overcome it, and they'd built a whole family and built a whole career, but ultimately that came crashing down and left the church in disgrace and divorced from his wife. And I remember him telling me, Kevin, he said, "Colby, you'll never know what it's like to stand on the platform every Sunday of your life for, I don't know how long this guy has been doing it, 30 years, every Sunday for 30 years, leading people in worship and prayer, feeling like a complete failure." That's what he said. "You'll never know what it's like." And I'm like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Because my entire life, I've been told that I just need to pray and God would heal me of this, and that God would take away these desires, and that God would, you know, now we call it pray away the gay." You know, he obviously had maybe a more elegant way to put it, or a less brash way to put it. But he said, "That's what I felt for 30 years. I felt because my attraction, my innate attraction, of which I always had, because it never went away, every single Sunday, I felt like a failure. I felt like a fraud." And he's right, Kevin. I don't know what that's like. Now, I've got my own ways in which I feel like failures and frauds, but not to that degree, to where you legitimately wonder about yourself, why has God not fixed me? Why has God not changed me? What have I done wrong? You know, the story of Job and his friends are like, "Bro, if you just sort of figure out the sin in your life, then this stuff will stop happening to you." And even though the story of Job is very clearly to point out that that sort of thinking is fraudulent and not of God, we still perpetuate it in the church as though it is true. Your life is not going the way it's supposed to go because you have some sin in your life. So when you ask that question, I think about, man, if us straight identifying folk could ever catch just a glimpse of what that must be like for young kids growing up in maybe religious or conservative homes, being taught either explicitly or implicitly from a young age that these desires and attractions that they didn't ask for, nobody decides who they're going to start being attracted to, whether it's men or women or a little bit of both or switches back and forth. None of us decide that. It's just part. It's a strange cocktail of nature and nurture, and we don't understand it. We probably never will. And why do we even need to understand it? At some point, let's just accept it. It's just part of who we are. But for those young kids who are taught explicitly or implicitly that those desires are disordered, unnatural, abominable, for them to then go through life, I mean, think about the layers of that. The shame that I even have these desires. Oh, that's embarrassing. Two, the fact that I can't really tell anybody because then they'll look at me different. They'll think me different. They'll like send me to some weird therapy. Three, maybe I did open up and now I am in this weird therapeutic process where I'm supposed to pray away the gay and it's not really working, but I seem rewarded to say that it is working. So there's this strange incentive to say that the gay has been prayed away. And so we pretend like it's gone. And now we try to live this heteronormative lifestyle only to have it blow up. So just the layers upon layers of feeling like a failure and feeling shame and being told that your acceptance here is conditional. What's my point? My point is that's a freaking lot. That's a lot. And Christians would do well to follow the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh, who says that understanding leads to compassion and compassion leads to love. And to your point earlier, any Christians that are still in sort of a non-affirming theological position, you need to understand what individuals deal with, have dealt with, have you need to hear their stories. You need to understand that, because that understanding leads to compassion. That leads to, oh my God, I had no idea. That makes so much sense. I'm so sorry. And then that opens up this path to love, to where now you're holding, you know, or you're letting a drag queen in the back hold on to your babies, even though inside you've got this inner tension. But that's the process. That is the process. It's never going to be instantaneous. It never has been for anybody. It's a journey. But man, yeah, may we listen and learn and hear more of these stories, because we need to hear them, because they'll change us. They will.
Yeah. Oh, so good. Off of that, Colby, one last question for the people listening in. I think one of the things that so naturally flows out of even our short time together is the unique sort of tender, you know, pastoral heart that you have for real people. So with that said, for people listening in who are in different stages of changing, inner shifts, growing, evolving, whether it's specifically about LGBTQ folks in the church or just in general, you know, and it's exciting and it's liberating, but it is scary. And we know there's loss that comes along with it. What do you say to people who are growing, but who still feel those barriers along the way of like, can I go there? Can I ask that question? Can I open that thing? What does that mean? What about my mom? What about my dad? What about my church? Do I move? Like, for people who are growing and evolving, but still have some fear in the way, still have some of those barriers that gets in the way of fully feeling the permission to be even more open. What is your pastoral word to them in this moment?
Yeah.
As they're in process, like you just said.
Yeah. I think first I would say, that's such a great question, Kevin. I'm glad you asked it. First I would want to normalize what they're feeling and say, yeah, that fear, that anxiety, that makes a lot of sense. Of course you would be anxious about that. Of course you would be hesitant to ask those questions, or of course that would feel really uncomfortable. A lot of times in the church, we're told that if it feels uncomfortable, that means it's of the devil. Like, those must feel bad. Well, no. What if it's just, you've been told one story your whole life, and that story has built into it certain tentacles that wrap themselves around you, and you're just starting to pull those tentacles off? It's going to feel uncomfortable. Of course it is. We talked about it earlier. If you're afraid that you might take out the one block that will damn your soul forever, that's heavy. So anyway, so first thing I would do is just normalize it. Like, yeah, it makes a lot of sense that it's scary. That doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It just is scary. This stuff is hard and it's heavy. And then two, I would say, but please know this. And person listening to this, you don't know me. I get that. So you have no reason to trust me. That's fine. But know this, that the love that everything flows from, the love that contains all things, the one in whom we live and move and have our being, the love that has been here from the beginning and will be here forever, that love is yours. It is in you. It is for you. And that has absolutely nothing to do with what you think or believe. It really doesn't. It really doesn't. There is no condition by which you must pass in order for the God of the universe to absolutely be ridiculously in love with you. You can be free to think and believe whatever you want, and it will not change. It will not change. The psalmist says, where can I go to escape the spirit? What height, what depth, how far can I travel? And the conclusion is nowhere. There's nowhere that we can go. Paul said the same thing, like neither height nor depth, nothing. There's nowhere we can go to escape this great love. So be free to ask the questions. Be free to change your mind. Good gravy. It's fine to change your mind. There is no shame in that. There is no shame in being like, I used to think this thing and now I don't. huh, that's interesting. So I would normalize it. Then I would make sure that they know that they are loved entirely and that is independent of whatever they might think or believe. And then I would invite them to just be looser and freer and open with their faith, knowing that faith is not about collecting the correct beliefs. Faith, Kevin, is like my cat, Nala. My cat, Nala, spends her entire day walking around our house in search of the spots where the sun comes beaming in through the windows so that she can lay in the sunspot on the floor and turn over and just expose her belly and warm her belly to the sun. Mm-hmm. For me, Kevin, this is what faith is. Faith is the sense that out there, there is this great light, this great love, and it is the constant awareness and openness to be like, maybe if I open up this way, it will warm me. And sometimes we fall asleep, like Nala falls asleep and she wakes up and the sun has moved and she's like, oh, now I got to go find the sun again. Let me go see where the light is at. And that's just the human journey. We're constantly opening and turning to the light. That's what faith is. Faith is openness. Faith is trust that God is good and that God loves us and that we're okay.
Mm. So good, man. I'm so glad I asked that last question. For people listening in, Colby Martin, man, what a gift it is for us to spend this last hour together, and what a gift. I hope the people listening in also have had the space while they're listening to take all that in as the real, real gift that it is. And even after the last 10 minutes, if anyone wants to rededicate their life to Jesus, DM Colby. You can find him on Instagram. I'm sure he probably would be totally open to you sending him any messages after that.
Of course.
As we wrap up, Colby's two books, the first, Unclobber. Check that out. It not only talks about the unique passages in the Bible that have been traditionally used to quote unquote clobber people, you know, out of their, you know, to clobber people with traditional views on sexuality and same sex attraction. But every other chapter tells Colby's unique story as well through this, which is why I love the format of that book so much. The second book, The Shift, Surviving and Thriving After Moving from Conservative to Progressive Christianity. Check that out. And what if people also wanted to follow along your journey more, what are other places you would point them towards too, Colby?
Yeah, right now I got a couple things going on that I'm real excited about. One is I write a weekly newsletter called Perspective Shift, and that goes out every Wednesday mornings. It's a free newsletter. People can go to colbymartin.substack.com. If that's too confusing, just Instagram at Colby Martin, Facebook, just Google my name. My name's unique enough that it's easy to find me. But I write this weekly letter called Perspective Shift. And then what I do, Kevin, is I go online at 2 p.m. on Wednesdays, Pacific time. And I do a live show on YouTube and Facebook on every Wednesday where we talk about that weekly article. And I write these articles about religion, spirituality, psychology, kind of the ways that these three fields overlap and interact. So that's a ton of fun. And then second, my wife and I, we have a podcast / live show called The Kate and Colby Show. And we are similar to you, my wife and I, we co-pastor our church together, and we're really curious about this idea of holistic care for the soul. And so we do a live podcast show every Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Again, that's Pacific time. So those two things, I think people would really get a kick out of if they wanted
those to. Are great. Yeah. So everybody, listeners, check both of those out. Find Colby Martin on Instagram. I'm sure you can find him just by his name, wherever he's at. And follow, if you have been if there's anything good that's come from this, if you've received any of that, which there is so much good stuff there, please follow along with his journey as he helps lead the church, you know, his church, our church, into a more hopeful future, man, which I believe he's doing such a great job of, and I'm so grateful for personally. So Colby, man,
right on.
Appreciate you so much, man.
Thanks,
Kev. Thank you for coming on. And like I say to some guests, not all, hopefully the next time or one of the next times we talk, we'll be here face to face, figuring out ways to get you and the family out here in Hawaii to,
that'd be dope.
To partner and do some things together. And also for the people listening, especially from out here, to be able to meet you and hear you in person. So man, thank you.
Make it happen.
Yeah, that would be good. That's my line to make those trans kind of cultural connections. I'm like, dude, I'm in Hawaii. Everyone wants an excuse to come here. Mm-hmm. Let's make that happen. So yeah, man, you have a good, what is today? Thursday. And, we'll We'll be in touch soon, man. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks, Kev.